WBAI New York at 99.5 FM, WBAI.org. On the web, it's 7 o'clock here in New York City, 76 degrees at 7 a.m. Coming up next, it's a good day. It's a good day with Johanna Fernandez.
Johanna Fernandez, Pacifica Radio, WBAI, New York.
Our show this morning will be a little bit different than usual. This is the first of a few episodes we'll run over the next several weeks where we turn the focus inside to what is happening in jails and prisons as the COVID-19 pandemic and the summer of rebellion rage on. While we continue to report on the unprecedented revolutionary energy that we see moving in the streets, as well as the massive repression the state has brought upon protesters, we know that these elements of resistance and repression are present behind the walls of prisons and jails. And of course, we know that prisoners are among the most targeted by the structural violence of our healthcare system, which in the time of COVID-19 has never been more dangerous. We don't often hear directly from incarcerated people or their loved ones. And in fact, the perspectives of prisoners are rarely placed front and center in public discourse. But jailhouse journalists like Mumia Abu-Jamal, Kevin Rashid Johnson, and so many others have provided illuminating analysis and reporting on social problems for decades. And we are eager to work with currently and formerly incarcerated people as we do our part to respond to and analyze this extraordinary moment. I know how it feels. I know how it feels to be free. Yeah, yeah. I know how it feels. Our show today includes an essay written and recorded by Justin Kalibi. Justin is currently incarcerated in a federal prison in Georgia at FCI Jessup. We also bring to you an interview with Naisha, whose loved one is currently held at MDC Brooklyn. In March, Justin Kalibi, who goes by Just, became a part of the It's a Good Day community. We met Just in part because they became involved with the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee's New York City chapter when they met some of the black youth ensnared in the Bronx 120 raids a couple of years ago. Just wanted to participate in the discussion on prison abolition and to share their perspective on the conditions they deal with in the federal prison system. As you might remember, we've heard from Just on this show several times, as they've shared their thoughts on the Bronx 120 raid, the COVID lockdown of the Bureau of Prisons, and when they read the heart-stopping letter they wrote to the imprisoned radio journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal. When we first met Just, I asked them to share some of their story, and I was startled to learn how Just was targeted and entrapped by the NYPD's intelligence division. The NYPD has spent years illegally targeting Muslim communities, And this is Just's story of entrapment at the hands of the NYPD. Just is white. As a teenager, they converted to Islam. At the age of 16, they met a man who later they discovered was a cop. The officer exploited Just's vulnerability, pretended to befriend them, while really building a case against Just. Shortly after Just turned 18, they were arrested and sent to prison to serve a 13-year sentence. This meant that Just has been forced to grow up behind the walls of prison where, among other horrors, they've endured the tortures of solitary confinement. It struck us that Just's story essentially amounted to child abuse on the part of the entire system, from the cops to the prosecutors to the judge, to the elected officials who wrote the laws that throw away kids like Just every day. This large-scale targeting of black communities grew out of COINTELPRO's assault on black radical organizers in the 1960s and 70s. It also is the result of the wave of Islamophobia that grew out of the so-called War on Terror of the 1990s, Bill Clinton's Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996, and the aftermath of 9/11. Abroad, we have seen the people of Iraq and Afghanistan demonized in order to garner public approval for the United States' imperialist war-making, while at home, kids are vilified to feed the insatiable hunger of mass incarceration, our modern-day slavery. But Just's story is not one of passive victimhood. It is a story fundamentally defined by survival and resistance to the brutality they continue to face daily behind bars. In recent weeks, one of our producers, Jürgen Ostensen, has been working very closely with Just to launch a project they envisioned called Prisons Kill. Just has written about abuses they have witnessed and experienced and encouraged their comrades in Jessup, Georgia, and across Prison Nation to do the same. Hashtag Prisons Kill was envisioned along the lines of Me Too as a space where formerly and currently incarcerated people can share stories on their own terms. This first installment focuses on MDC Brooklyn, New York City's federal detention center where Just was previously incarcerated. Right now, MDC is crawling with COVID-19 and houses political prisoners from the recent uprisings. As we have previously reported, the Sunset Park Popular Assembly and other prison abolitionist groups have organized rallies and noise demos outside of MDC over the past month to protest the violence taking place on the inside, including the murder of Jamel Floyd with pepper spray not long ago. Let's listen to a clip from one of the protests featuring 7-year-old Winta Amor Rogers. At the beginning of the clip, the child makes reference to the sounds of prisoners inside the jail making noise to show their support. Let's take a listen.
You hear all those people knocking?
Yeah.
You hear all those people knocking?
We bring these voices to you at a moment when the concept of abolition is a growing discussion and demand in public discourse. The call to abolish prisons and police is also a call for funding hospitals, for funding schools, and for affordable housing developments, for funding mental health clinics, community wellness centers, and the creation of livable wage jobs with dignity. This special episode of It's a Good Day will feature Jess's first hashtag Prisons Kill essay and an interview produced by Jorgen Ostensen, conducted with a woman named Nyasia, whose loved one is currently held at MDC. Let's take a listen.
Hello, everyone. My name is Jorgen Ostensen, and I am one of the producers of It's a Good Day. In a few moments, you are about to hear from my dear friend and comrade, Justin Kalibi, who is currently incarcerated in a federal prison in Georgia. Just is a friend of the It's a Good Day show, and we have aired their commentary several times over the last few months. Lately, Just and I have been working to launch a project they envisioned called Hashtag Prisons Kill. As Just is about to tell you, the goal of Hashtag Prisons Kill is to show the world that prisons are inherent death traps. We believe the best way to do this is to flip the script on the narrative of incarceration by encouraging and empowering currently and formerly incarcerated people to share their stories of the abuses they witnessed and faced on their own terms. Just's first essay is about their time at MDC Brooklyn, where they were incarcerated from 2013 to 2016. While they were there, they listened to WBAI, which became one of the only places they were able to hear radical perspectives on what was happening outside. If you are at MDC now and are listening, this broadcast is for you. We want you to know that you matter too. If you have a story to tell, we are here to listen and to do our best to share it with the world. Please write to us. Our address is Albert Jackson, P.O. Box 863, 50 U.S. Highway 46, Pine Brook, New Jersey, 07058-9998. If you write to us, please let us know what your preferences are for anonymity and pronouns. Once again, the address is Albert Jackson, P.O. Box 863, 50 U.S. Highway 46, Pine Brook, New Jersey, 07058-9998. If you are on the outside and have a story to tell, please reach out to our email, which is prisonskill@protonmail.com. Once again, that's prisonskill@protonmail.com. If you would like to learn more about this project, visit our Twitter account, which can be found by typing in @prisonskill. Once again, that is @prisonskill. There you will find more content from Just and their comrade Tay, who wrote a beautiful essay about how negligence from a CO caused the death of his cellmate. Now let's take a listen to our comrade Justin Kalibi.
Brooklyn's Metropolitan Detention Center can be overlooked as just another warehouse on the harbor to those who are uninitiated, to those whose lives have not been touched by the horrors of America's prison system. Some pass by it or see it from afar, never knowing what lies beyond the steel gates and vomit-brown facade. Such an innocent passerby can be forgiven for that first impression. For in many respects, it is what it appears to be. A warehouse for the poor situated in Sunset Park, Brooklyn, that holds about 1,600 souls at the time of this recording. Depending on which side of the steel and concrete of this your cell is located on, you can catch glimpses of any number of New York City's social, cultural, and economic landmarks. Maybe you'll find yourself waking up in the morning with the view of the Statue of Liberty staring at you with a taunting glare from her imperial pedestal. Go to another part of the jail, and you can catch a glimpse of a thoroughly gentrifying Brooklyn skyline featuring the Barclays Center. Both are abiding reminders of the true location of MDC Brooklyn, or any U.S. prison for that matter, on the corner of white supremacy and neoliberal capitalism. I was in the mental health / medical unit, dubbed the special programs unit, because it was one step away from being in the special housing unit from 2013 to 2016 when it was shut down. K81 was situated on the building's east floor. The hole was on the ninth. It was on the Barclays Center side, and perhaps that was fitting, Florida held captive the types of people who are driven out of their communities so such developments can occur unimpeded, so that they won't offend the sensibilities of its new residents. K-81 was a relatively safe unit for the vulnerable, the homeless, substance users, the mentally and physically handicapped, sexual abuse survivors, and for queer, trans, and gender non-conforming people. All were humans with dreams deferred. All were harmless, yet victims of state-sponsored harm, including outrageous medical neglect that most certainly amounted to torture. A stark illustration of this was a close friend of mine, Molina. Jovial and always singing the Spanish language gospel melodies of his own creation, it was hard not to know him. But Molina had manifold difficulties. In federal custody for his alleged role in an attempted bank robbery, he would end up stuck at MTC for 5 years. He had no family or community support, so that meant no visits, and the only money he had came from a $20 to $30 a month job buffing the unit's floor and doing just about anything the counselor said he needed to get done. He spoke little English and was illiterate in his native Spanish. When asked about his court date, the name of his lawyer, even his official charges, his reply was a shrug of the shoulders, accompanied by a frown. In the 3 years I spent with him, I'd never seen him attend a legal visit. A prisoner differs from a slave in that the former's life is expendable. The only factors that give value to that life is community backlash and thus the threat of a loss. Needless to say, it's difficult to be someone like Molina when he was in custody, especially given all of the health issues that he was afflicted with. Molina had Tourette syndrome, severe PTSD, major depression, hypertension, diabetes, and sleep apnea. He was also dying of an easily curable disease, syphilis. To see him on a daily basis was to watch someone physically deteriorate before your very eyes. That was because, as was apparent, the medical department at MDC Brooklyn was taking a firm position not to treat him. It all began one night, according to him, when he noticed the sore on his penis. He complained by filing for sick call, BOP parlance for triage. But as was typical, he wasn't seen for several weeks. But that time, the sore became an infection. Molina was writhing in pain. MDC's response was to tell him to buy ibuprofen from Commissar. He was finally rushed to the hospital when he couldn't urinate for a few days, causing him to faint in his cell one night. The infection was so bad that the hospital had to do emergency surgery. They had to remove part of his genitalia. The hospital gave Molina a prescription for an antibiotic treatment and some pain medication and set a follow-up date. MDC Brooklyn didn't honor any of that. In no time, the infection came back, spreading to other parts of his body. Now bumps were beginning to appear all over his head, moldy green and crusty. After a while, his hands were swollen like boxing gloves, and his brown skin turned black in some places. But Molina was still singing songs and watching novelas on TV, periodically looking back at me or someone else, pointing to his hands, pain and fear in his eyes. As I mentioned before, Molina had Tourette syndrome, so he would often shout random words and phrases and laugh out loud.
This call is from a federal prison.
According to the sadistic calculus of the medical department, if he was singing and laughing, then that meant he was fine. They even implied at one point that he may be somehow faking his illness. Staff, whether it be the counselor who he worked for, the psychologists who ran the unit, or COs and lieutenants, saw him in that state every day. Some expressed sympathy, many remained silent, while others even joked about it. Every other Monday, the warden and administrative staff toured the unit. They showed more concern about the cleanliness of Molina's cell than they did about his affliction. Some of us would ask one of them directly, "Are you going to let this man die?" Missing was the standard snide cop response. "What are you, his lawyer?" No, because deep down, every one of them knew that they were wrong. So they'd approach him and ask him how he was doing. All Molina would do was make a childlike frown in response. Every morning I'd take a deep breath and look into his cell while he was asleep, checking for signs of life. I feared the day was coming when I wouldn't find him. His stomach was now bloated, the whites of his eyes yellow. I often called my mother, telling her what I was seeing, half hoping that the jail would pick up on me talking about it and do something. My cellie and I had already wrote a letter to the DOJ's Inspector General with the signatures of everybody on the unit. Nothing but a formulaic response in return. Myself and other detainees started counseling Molina to fall to the floor and play dead while one of us screamed for help. For them, they would be forced to at least take them out of the unit. But he was afraid of retaliation, and no one blamed him for that. MDC Brooklyn made a culture out of it, and he had real experience to back up his fear. For one day, Molina got frustrated about medical's indifference and shouted at the PA, telling him that he was going to complain about him in an official grievance, a BPA. His quote-unquote caregiver accused him of threatening an officer, and he was soon surrounded by a dozen of them, mace at the ready, handcuffs singing their ominous jingle. Molina was Molina until he couldn't be anymore. He stopped singing and resigned himself to his bed and his feet. The only traces of him were in the shouts and cries that you would hear come from his cell in the depths of night. Help would arrive in the form of a jailhouse lawyer, a disabled, passionate, fearless trans woman passing through to another facility. We found that the solution was fairly simple. The Prison Litigation Reform Act made it impossible to file suit in federal court, whether it be for an injunction or monetary damages, without going through a bureaucratic in-house remedy process first. That could take up to 6 months or even longer, notwithstanding obstacles such as retaliation and loss really destroyed paperwork. Molina couldn't wait for that. For one right that the PLRA didn't take away,
this call is from a federal prison,
was access to his judge, to whom she would write an eloquent letter, effectively bypassing the red tape. The letter made the argument that not only was Molina going to torture, both in the literal and legalistic sense, but she also made the point that it had a direct and immediate impact on his due process rights. Not only did MDC Brooklyn have a responsibility to take care of him as a matter of law, but it was necessary for his ability to stand before a judge and play an active role in his own defense. Molina's judge agreed, and it wasn't long before he was sent to the hospital. This time, the jail didn't withhold his antibiotics and sent him back for follow-up treatment. He would suffer complications related to his other medical conditions, including an abscess for which the dentist pulled out the wrong tooth until his release from jail in 2016. Right now, in 2020, we are in the midst of a global pandemic, unprecedented in our lifetimes. COVID-19 and the responses to it worldwide has laid bare pre-existing conditions of capitalism and its priorities. Just like environmental catastrophe, this pandemic is hardly taking a neutral course. Those who are hardest hit are those who are already deemed by the capitalist imperialist system to be expensive. The virus has prison nation to the point where entire jail populations have been infected, due in part to the impossibility of social distancing in a carceral setting. To those of us who are held captive or know somebody who did, it comes as no surprise that the people in power, both in the state and federal level, would rather let us die than decarcerate. Therefore, the goal of hashtag prisons kill is to share accounts of people such as Molina from the perspective of the currently and formerly incarcerated, their families and supporters, of medical neglect and malpractice, as well as environmental toxicity behind the barbed wire fences and walls of America's prisons. The goal of hashtag prisons kill is to show you how prisons are inherent death traps, how they've been letting us die before COVID-19. And that will continue to be so until we let the system die. Prisons kill.
That was Justin Kalibi's essay, which is entitled Hashtag Prisons Kill. Once again, if you are at MDC and have a story to tell, please write to us. Our address is Albert Jackson, P.O. Box 863, 50 U.S. Highway 46, Pine Brook, New Jersey, 07058-9998. If you write to us, please let us know what your preferences are for anonymity and pronouns. Once again, the address is Albert Jackson, P.O. Box 863, 50 U.S. Highway 46, Pine Brook, New Jersey, 07058-9998. And once again, if you're on the outside and have a story to tell, please reach out to our email, which is prisonskill@protonmail.com. Once again, that's prisonskill@protonmail.com. If you would like to learn more about this project, visit our Twitter account, which can be found by typing in @prisonskill. Once again, that is @prisonskill. There you will find more content from Just and their comrade Tay, who wrote a beautiful essay about how negligence from a CO caused the death of his cellmate. Here is I Find It Hard to Say by Lauryn Hill, a song just picked to accompany this broadcast. Hill wrote this song as a response to the NYPD's brutal murder of Amadou Diallo in 1999.
Okay, yeah, all right. I find it hard to say that everything is all right. Don't look at me that way, like everything is all right. 'Cause my own eyes can see through all your false pretenses, but what you fail to see is all the consequences. You think our lives are cheap and easy to be wasted as history repeats. So foul you can taste it. People sleep, too comfortable to face it. His life so incomplete, and nothing can replace it. And while the people sleep, and nothing can replace. myself, I said, against these laws of man. 'Cause like the Bible says, his blood is on the hands. And what I gotta say,
since the beginning of the pandemic, the situation at MDC Brooklyn has continually gotten worse and worse. On March 21st, a prisoner tested positive for the virus, making them the first person to be infected in the federal system. It is impossible to know how many cases of the virus there are at the facility because the prison has continually misrepresented how many people are infected. Even the correctional officers have complained about the lack of transparency. Instead of heeding the calls for decarceration, the BOP put all their facilities on lockdown after the pandemic set in. Prisoners have continually described the lockdown as a form of collective punishment. Since the middle of March, visits have been discontinued and access to showers, phone calls, fresh air, and recreation have been severely limited across the BOP and at MDC. On May 19th, Kenneth Houck, who was only 44, died under mysterious circumstances at MDC. His family still do not know what happened to him. Then George Floyd was murdered on May 25th, and protests erupted in cities across the nation. A week later, the BOP decided to put all their facilities into a state of total 24-hour lockdown. This was a clear attempt to repress communication between prisoners and organizers on the outside, as concepts like prison and police abolition started to get more attention than they ever had before. On June 3rd, with the protest lockdown in full effect, prison guards at MDC murdered Jamel Floyd. Floyd, who was 120 days out from his release, was asthmatic and died after being maced in his cell. The guards certainly knew he was at risk, defying their own protocol to abstain from macing people with asthma. All this has combined to create nightmarish conditions for prisoners at MDC and for those on the outside who love them. Earlier this month, I interviewed Nyasia, whose loved one Kyle is currently incarcerated at the facility. Let's take a listen to our conversation.
Why don't you just start by telling us a little bit about what's been going on? Just give us like a little overview.
Okay. I was arrested in February. We've been going back and forth to court for a while. Unfortunately, due to COVID, he hasn't been to court in the last few months. So we're kind of just in the waiting process of finding out what's to come. This entire experience has been dreadful. It's probably one of the worst situations I've ever been in my life. DOP, their standards are just outrageous. They were on lockdown for COVID, which was understandable, being that, you know, there were so many, not only prisoners, but workers were also infected. So I kind of understood them taking precautionary measures to kind of reduce the spread of COVID. But the way they did it, I think, was inhumane. They would only allow them out once a week to take a shower. They would only be allowed to use the phone once a week. And being on the outside, that's scary, not hearing from your loved ones.
Yeah.
And when you try to call and check on them, it's like they don't say they're fine. They'll say, yeah, he's here. Well, yes, I know he's there. I checked, but I want to know, is he okay? Well, we can't give that kind of information out. So it's kind of like, you know, there are people that love them. We want to check on them. And you only allowing them out once a week is not okay. You allowing them to shower once a week is not okay. And then they put them on lockdown or the protest, which made no sense to me because no one's coming in MDC. No one's bothering you inside. So, you know, they were just being ridiculous. But unfortunately, he's been in the shu for a month. Waiting to have his tickets or whatever it is, whatever the standards are that they use, waiting to have it reviewed to then release him. But I guess, you know, it's on their time whenever they feel like doing it. So it's been over a month at this point. So that's unfortunate. They only get two calls a month in the shu.
Yeah.
So actually, when I spoke to him 2 weeks ago, I was thinking about doing this interview, and he said, yeah, because the conditions here are horrible. I actually have water dripping on my head from the ceiling right now.
Wow.
So I could only imagine, you know, how bad it is. So.
Yeah, and we know, like we've been following the situation at MDC, and we know that there were cases of the virus. I think actually it was the first federal facility that had cases of the virus.
So when this COVID thing first started, I remember actually being the one to tell how many inmates were infected, because on the BOP website, they kind of updated every afternoon about 3:30. So I would always check it and say, okay, well, it says there are 3 COs and 3 inmates with it. And he'll say, wow, no one told us. So they were kind of in the dark about what was going on there. And that's scary, you know. And then they did start to give them masks, because I would always ask them, well, do you have a mask? No, we don't have a mask. And then eventually they gave them masks, which I guess they made themselves. He said it was probably like the lowest grade of quality available. And being that they weren't able to shower often means they weren't able to wash their hands.
Right.
So I can totally understand, you know, why they had so many cases, because no one's washing their hands, and it's sad.
Yeah, and can you talk a little bit about what that was like for you psychologically, just knowing that like constantly there's the threat of, you know, really horrible infection and could be deadly?
It was draining for me because I work in the medical profession.
Hmm.
So I saw firsthand what COVID was doing to people, and then to worry that, you know, my loved one is in this place with, you know, people who really have no regards for his well-being, and he can only practice safe measures, you know, a little, because there's no water, there's no soap. So what do you do? There's nothing you can do. And so I was very, very worried about him for a long time. I'm still worried.
Yeah.
And BOP, they're not, especially MDC, they're not being honest, you know, about the cases. So that's even more scary.
Yeah. And what was his reaction? Like, how, when you talked to him probably sporadically, like you sort of described, how did he feel about the situation? Like, was it something that, I mean, obviously solitary confinement, right, is already really by most countries, and the United Nations even considers it to be torture. And now you have also, on top of that, you have this virus, which has taken a psychological toll on a lot of people. Like, what did you notice in those conversations that you had? And, like, how do you think that it's been impacting Kyle?
So when this pandemic started, he was actually still in general population. And so, right. You know, he was worried about me, but I was worried about him. You know, my question was, well, are they wiping down the phones? Are they wiping down this? And it's like, no, they're not wiping down anything. So you kind of have to be accountable for yourself and the next person. And so, you know, he was worried, of course. And he's an asthmatic, so that made it even worse. There was a time that he was short of breath, and he asked to go to the medic. And I think he waited, 2 days before a doctor actually saw him.
Mm.
Which, of course, you know, me hearing that, it's like, no way. You know, luckily he was fine after the 2 days passed, but this could have been a different story. I could have been, you know, God forbid, saying he passed away because he was denied, you know, to see the medic.
Right. And I think, did he tell you anything about, like, how, like, I imagine that the other people in there, the other prisoners, probably were treated in much the same way. Did he tell you anything about that?
He didn't mention it, but in his letter, it did say, you know, seems like no one wants to do their job. And there was a point when he said the regular COs at MDC weren't even there. It was like other people dressed in plain clothes. So confused about that too. And, you know, you can't really ask questions. Well, you can ask, but you probably won't get a solid answer.
I'm just wondering about the communication. Like, I know there's been a long history of pretty repressive or violent things that are violent conditions that have been at MDC. Like, I know a couple of years ago there was a really big issue with the heating there at MDC. Now, like, even recently we've had a man was murdered by the correctional officers there, like, within the last 2 weeks. Could you talk a little bit about how, like, the lockdown, which created the situation where you weren't able to communicate with your loved one, can you talk about how that created issues for you? Like, it seems very much to me like a choice to, by the prison at least, to choose punishment over care. But could you sort of talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so with the lockdown, when he was in general population, I only got to see him maybe once a week. And then with this second lockdown going on, and so the suicide and the murder, they have been very strict with them making phone calls. He told me that they're worried about them reaching out to the media. So they don't want to let them use the phone.
Mm.
And they're holding their mail, because I don't know if you guys know, but they copy each piece of mail that comes in. And so I sent him, I'd say a total of 8 letters, and he probably didn't get them until a week ago, and it's been a month.
Wow.
So, you know, they're just really trying to cover their behind. Even, I think it came out earlier this week about the other death at MVC. But I had actually heard about that 3 weeks ago. It was a suicide.
Right.
And, you know, so they are really trying to keep them from communicating with the outside world, but they don't understand that it makes us worry. We're worried because of the pandemic. They're, you know, they're mistreated. There's a lot going on. Like, use the phone, it doesn't help any.
Right. And just based on what you said, the correctional officers literally said that they didn't want people to communicate with the media.
That's what Kyle said to me. He said they don't want us to use the phone because they're worried about us contacting the media.
Right. Wow. So thank you for speaking for Kyle, I guess, because they can't, yeah. They're not letting him speak. So then the next thing I want to ask about is there's obviously this huge amount of protests in New York City and there's a whole situation and the BOP decides to put the more serious lockdown in place. Could you just talk about that a little bit? What was kind of going through your mind, following the news about the protests in the streets, but then also with your loved one being in prison? Could you just talk a little bit about the last few weeks and what that's been like?
So they were kind of letting up on the lockdown as far as COVID. They were letting them, you know, have a little bit more freedom. They were letting them out a little more often. And then when I saw the second lockdown, it's like, wow, it's a double whammy. It's a COVID lockdown and now it's a protest lockdown. So now there's no movement. There's no phone calls. There's no emails. There's nothing.
Right. Go ahead.
No.
And then, I think it was the day after the second lockdown started, maybe the day after, 2 days after, that man Jamel Floyd was murdered by the police by the correctional officers using pepper spray. He obviously was, I'm pretty sure, asthmatic. Could you talk a little bit about that situation and how it impacted you? On top of, you already have the threat of a virus. It just feels almost like an unbelievable amount of cruelty at this point. But could you just sort of talk a little bit about what it was like to process the fact that a man had been murdered in the same place where Kyle is at?
So first hearing of suicide a few weeks ago, and then hearing of someone being murdered, my heart sunk. Because at first, there's no name. You know, it's just a man was killed. And that could be any man. That could be anyone. And so, you know, for a good while, you're worried that it's your loved one. You know, I'm sad that it's anyone's loved one. But it was horrible. It was really bad. And I feel so terrible, you know, for his entire family.
Yeah. And I imagine it's just impossible to sort of, understand why something like this would happen. Could you talk a little bit about, I guess this is a moment where so many people are coming into the streets and so many people are being made aware of this, massive issue in this country of police brutality. And yet this story of Jamel Floyd being murdered did not get the same kind of coverage and did not become the same kind of story that some of the other more high-profile, police murders that have taken place. And I think some people are thinking, and I think the fact that he was in prison and potentially guilty of some crime that, in that man's case, I think it was a crime he committed some 15 years ago or something like that. But the fact that they were guilty of a crime kind of makes it different in some way than someone being on the street who was murdered by the police. Could you talk a little bit about how it's important, or what you think basically about the need to include incarcerated people in discussions about police brutality and to think about the police, the violence done by correctional officers, which is another form of police violence?
Sure. There's a stigma that the feds can indict Hampton. Right, because that they run their own standards. Anyone, you know, can be indicted in the Fed. And so I think it's really important that we give free people as well as people who are incarcerated the same respect. and especially CEOs, because I feel as though they have a chip on their shoulders. And yes, they're called New York's bravest. Right. I've worked with many people who have been incarcerated, and they're just like you and I, you know? Right. They're human, regardless of the circumstances, and they need to be treated as such. And it's so unfair to see them not getting as much coverage or not as much justice as others because of some choices or even some mistakes that they've made. So I think it's very unfortunate.
Right. Right. I think, yeah. Could you talk a little bit about the bigger picture of what you think should happen with these prisons that seem to be filled with abuse?
I think these prisons should be held accountable, first and foremost. I saw that in D.C. there was actually a lawsuit against them or something for false numbers or something of the sort. But I just feel like because of the stigma that because they're incarcerated, they're not as important, that the jails don't get held accountable as they should. I personally don't even think that there's a need for jail. There's no point, you know, but that's just my personal opinion. But I think that the bigger picture is everyone needs to be treated with the same respect.
Hmm.
And I think if there were repercussions, I think things would be a lot different. But, you know, these CEOs, they're family pretty much. And so they kind of cover for one another, making it hard for everyone to get justice. So, especially in like these murders, I don't feel that BOP should investigate BOP.
Right.
There's no fairness in that.
No.
That's just my opinion.
But could you just tell us a little bit about this person who's in this situation, who can't really speak for themselves right now? But if they could, what do you think they would say? And can you just maybe share a little bit about their story and their life a little bit?
Sure. So Kyle is the dad three, probably the nicest person you'd ever meet. He's so sweet. He's so caring. He's so genuine. Like I said, this is probably the worst experience in his life because he's good to people. Have people just being good to him, kind of mind baffles, and I truly feel bad for him. I'm sure if he could speak for himself, you'd say everything that you guys have been saying at the protest, freedom all.
There you have it. I don't think anyone could possibly ever say it better than that. Free them all. I'd like to thank Nyasia and Just for participating in our show today. Once again, if you are at MDC now and are listening, this broadcast is for you. We want you to know that you matter too. If you have a story to tell, we are here to listen and to do our best to share it with the world. Please write to us. Our address is Albert Jackson, P.O. Box 863, 50 U.S. Highway 46, Pine Brook, New Jersey, 07058-9998. If you write to us, please let us know what your preferences are for anonymity and pronouns. Once again, the address is Albert Jackson, P.O. Box 863, 50 U.S. Highway 46, Pine Brook, New Jersey, 07058-9998. If you are on the outside and have a story to tell, please reach out to our email, which is prisonskill@protonmail.com. Once again, that's prisonskill@protonmail.com. If you would like to learn more about this project, visit our Twitter account, which can be found by typing in @prisonskill. Once again, that is @prisonskill. There you will find more content from Just and their comrade Tay, who wrote a beautiful essay about how negligence from a CO caused the death of his cellmate. Now let's take a listen to Police State by Dead Prez, another track picked out by our comrade Just. For more, check out @prisonskill on Twitter. Prisonskill.
You have the emergence in human society of this thing that's called the state. What is the state? The state is this organized bureaucracy. It is the police department. It is the army, the navy. It is the prison system, the courts, and what have you. This is the state. It is a repressive organization. But the state, and well, you know, you've got to have the police, because if there were no police, look at what you'd be doing to yourselves. You'd be killing each other if there were no police. But the reality is, the police become necessary in human society. Only at that juncture in human society, where it is split between those who have and those who ain't got.
I throw a Molotov cocktail at the precinct. You know how we think. Organize the hood under our Ching banners. Red, black, and green instead of gang bandanas. FBI spying on us through the radio antennas. And I'm hitting cameras in the streetlight watching society. With no respect for the people's right to privacy. I take a slug for the cause like Huey P. While all you fake niggas try to copy Master P. I wanna be free to live, able to have what I need to live. Bring the power back to the street where the people live. We sick of working for crumbs and filling up the prisons. Dying over money and relying on religion for help. We do for self like ants in a colony. Organize the wealth into a socialist economy. A way of life based off the common needs. And all my comrades is ready, we just spreading the seed.
The average black male live a third of his life in a jail cell. Cause the world is controlled by the white male. And the people don't never get justice. And the women don't never get respected. And the problems don't never get solved. And the jobs don't never pay enough. So the rent always be late. Can you relate?
No more bondage, no more political monsters, no more secret space launches. Government department started it in the projects, material objects, thousands up in the closets. Could have been invested in the future for my comrades. Battle contacts, primitive weapons out in combat. Many never come back, pretty be running with gas. Rather get shot in they back than fire back. We tired of that. Corporations hiring blacks, denying the facts, exploiting us all over the map. That's why I write the shit I write in my raps. It's documented, I meant it. Every day of the week, I live in it, breathe in it. It's more than just fucking believe in it. I'm holding in ones, rolling up my sleeves and shit. It's C-Lo for push-ups now. Many headed for one conclusion. Niggas ain't ready for revolution.
The average black male live a third of his life in a jail cell. Cause the world is controlled by the white male. And the people don't never get justice. And the women don't never get respected. And the problems don't never get solved. And the jobs don't never pay enough. So the rent always be late. Can you relate? We living in a police state.
That's the end of our show for today. You've been listening to non-profit, listener-funded, community-controlled radio. WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York, streaming globally at WBAI.org. This show is produced by Jorgen Ostensen, Ajamo Sankofa, Shandani Smith, and Ellis Maxwell. Our interns are Davin Smith and Andrea Hidalgo. Michael G. Haskins is our board operator. I'm your host, Johanna Fernandez. Thanks for tuning in. It's a good day. See you tomorrow.
WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Wonderful outro. Thank you very much, Johanna. Jorgen Ostensen and the entire It's a Good Day team, thank you so very much. A job very, very well done. You are tuned to listener-sponsored, commercial-free community radio WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. Please stay tuned. Coming up in a moment will be Democracy Now! And you can make a contribution if you appreciated hearing what you just heard over the last hour. Please make a contribution in support of WBAI. You can call our pledge line that is open and available always, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Give us a call now at 516.